Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. This study of Genesis 20, Isaiah 61, and Galatians 3 explores the interconnected themes of faith, law, and righteousness. It traces the impact of Abraham's belief on all nations. God's promise to Abraham transcends the law of God, empowering believers to positively influence their communities. Biblical righteousness, forgiveness, and the responsibilities of the faithful are grounded in the transformative power of trust, or faith, in God. The parable of people as trees producing good fruit illustrates the reverberating effects of heaven's redemption of us and transformation of our characters. The result of our transformation is our obedience, or fruit.
So, Genesis 20, we obviously have this fun example. I say fun because a semi-repeat, as I say semi, it's not exact repeat with Abraham and Pharaoh, but same kind of idea. We have the storyline, which Abraham and Sarah, of course, they travel. Now, to begin with, they obviously have to leave. So the previous chapter discussing Sodom and Gomorrah's destruction, right? And Lot and all of his family and such. So essentially, because Sodom and Gomorrah was the primary trading partner with Abraham, and of course, I assume the men with Abraham, not just him, but the other merchants that Abraham was associated with. They bought various things from. So he would have purchased and bought and sold from the people of Sodom and Gomorrah as an oral business transaction, right? This is how businesses work. You have to have customers. So with the destruction of those cities, he's got to move. And so he moved off, and of course, he travels and travels to different spots. And he winds up going to further south, and then of course winds up in Gerar, which is more of the Philistine territory. It's kind of a part Philistine, part. It's a little confusing as to who actually lives there at this moment in time, because Philistines are actually invaders. These are invaders, and they were still in the process of conquering at the history of Abraham. But anyway, so the Philistines, roughly, or mostly Philistines, were occupies the territory, and they are now his new customers. Woohoo, right? Customers means business. All right, so he's got business going now, which is all great and wonderful. However, being a business center, which Gerar, of course, was one of the primary cities in the territory, a business center, when you look at Abraham and Sarah's relationship, it seems, I say this seems, kind of strange in that this repetition of this whole, sister-brother, storyline. Right, that this line they gave it obviously to Pharaoh, they gave it to Abimelech, and from the text here, it appears in verse 12, 13, or thereabouts, that this is actually not this is probably not the only two times Abraham and Sarah have done this. From Abraham's own words, it appears that this has been a tradition for the two of them when he goes to new towns. Now, it appears, however, that both with Egypt and Gerar here in this territory, it backfires, meaning something bad happens as a result. But it may have been that prior to this, it was not a backfire, meaning bad things didn't happen. Because it appears the way Abraham's describing it says, hey, this is a deal with my wife. Anytime we go somewhere that's new, this is what we do. We tell everybody that you're my sister and I'm your brother. And that's how we do it. And that's how they appears to have always done it, or done it very frequently. But this is an instance, much like Pharaoh's story was, an instance where it backfired, meaning something went wrong, an unplanned event. So I can't really complain or say, Abraham, you'll grow up, type of thing. No, this appears to be a normal sequence of events for the two of them. I can't explain all the reasons why, and I do not know all the places that Abraham and Sarah would have done this to, but I do know they traveled when they left his home country. And left his dad and such, and traveled all to Canaan. Well, it's been many years now. He's been in many different cities and towns along the way. So it's possible, I should say, actually, according to Abraham's own words, it's highly probable he did this to every place he went, or nearly every place they went. So this is a story which it backfires. And so we're going to come, of course, obviously, but much like Pharaoh, I'm going to, of course, accept her and says, hey, I like this girl, so I'm going to wind up taking her, abducts her. Now, although we can look at the story of Pharaoh with Sarah and Abraham and the story of Abimelech and Sarah and Abraham and see lots of similarities. There's a lot of similarities here. Not identical, but a lot of them are similar. But there's also some distinct differences. And I want to highlight a few of these differences. And that is, these differences are one of the threads, the common threads that we're going to discuss a little bit between the Genesis 20, Isaiah 61, and Galatians 3. So these differences are actually distinct and important or noteworthy. So in this storyline, of course, we obviously know Abraham moves. They come along the story. Abimelech kidnaps her or abducts her, or however you want to argue it. Basically says takes her as his wife. I don't know what all was involved in that, whether he paid Abraham at the time or not. I don't know. Clearly, I don't think he asked Sarah. He just did so. So unlike Pharaoh, who did so and then bad things happened, and Pharaoh, God never actually told Pharaoh what's wrong. God never spoke to Pharaoh. He just did. Bad things happened, and that was how Pharaoh learned something was wrong. Well, in the case of Abimelech, apparently bad things happened too. But unlike Pharaoh, God talks to him. So God, of course, comes and sends a message through, maybe it was a dream. I don't know however God spoke to Abimelech. So he winds up giving this message that he's going to punish him. He did not give the best reports of Pharaoh. Pharaoh had to figure it out, but Abimelech didn't have to figure it out. He actually got the warning and instruction what was going on. So in my opinion, this is Daniel's opinion here, I think Abimelech may have had a closer, maybe not a very good one, but a closer connection to God than Pharaoh had. I could be wrong. Maybe it's not true, but based on God's actions, it appears Abimelech may have been a closer relationship or had a better familiarity with the actual God, the real God, versus Pharaoh. I say that just because God appears to talk to Abimelech in some way, a message to him somehow, which God does not do to Pharaoh. So Abraham's claim, which we'll get to later, about, well, for sure that God is not in this place, these people don't know God, don't fear God, I don't know that's actually a true claim. It may be mostly true, but it doesn't seem to be the same as it was with Pharaoh, apparently, which Pharaoh didn't seem to argue with Abraham. But in this case, Abimelech, it doesn't hold true that Abimelech did not fear God, because clearly you have this storyline that God talks to him and explains what's going on, and Abimelech then responds. So there is some kind of a fear Abimelech has with the God of Abraham, while Pharaoh does not have the same type of fear or the same type of relationship. So when God comes and explains to Abimelech, hey, you can't do this. Bad things are happening to you and your family because of the way that you're acting. We got to change your behavior or alter your pathway, or something's bad. You are dying. Bottom line is your life is on the line. So in God, when he describes this to Abimelech, he threatens specifically Abimelech's life, and apparently the everything he owns. So includes the people he owns, not his kingdom, not the people of his nation, but him and his family. So it appears that God focuses on that. And it's interesting to me that in verse 4, though God threatened to kill Abimelech, and of course, obviously, apparently his wife and maid servants, and I'm not sure who else was in Abimelech's personal house, but at least those individuals are specifically cited. The king does not interpret God's words that way. So the king interprets the words, or at least he says interpret the word when he recounts this, that the entire nation, his whole nation, is being destroyed or affected by this problem. Now, it could be a sense of narcissism, anyway. So it's self-importance, that if something happens to me, my whole nation is destroyed. Well, that's a very self-centered individual, but which I'm like totally could be. But anyway, the king interprets and recounts this to people who he's talking to, that this is a destruction or attack on their country. It's not. God wasn't attacking their country. God was attacking him, just him. Which is consistent. Our God really focuses heavily on the people who are at fault. So we may not like to pay attention to those details, but we look at it carefully when we go through, which we're not going through obviously anytime soon, but Jeremiah discusses this in quite a very extensive detail. And that when he comes with Nebuchadnezzar later on, the idea that people that are being captured or sucked away, the exiles, Jeremiah points out that those are the ones God's protecting. Those are the ones God's saving. And those ones he's pulling away. The one that's the God leaves behind, God's going to wipe out. They're the ones he's destroying. So it tells us that God is not, his hand is not so short. They cannot isolate individual people as he picks them out of the lineup to which ones he's going to address in a destructive manner and which ones he's going to address in a protective manner. So God's not incapable of doing that, even in the midst of a massive slaughterhouse war. He's even capable of doing it in those instances. So in this scenario here with Abimelech, God essentially can do this as well. He's saying, okay, Abimelech, yeah, you have a whole nation. I don't know how many people there are, a few thousand, however big his country is, I don't know. You have a whole nation, but Abimelech, you're the individual I'm talking to. You're the one I have a problem with, not the rest of the people, but just you. So I'm going to address you and pick you out of everybody. So God is able and quite clearly decides to do a specific targeted response, a targeted action against Abimelech. Which, again, he did the same thing with Pharaoh too. It was against Pharaoh's house specifically God addressed. So God is very capable of selecting specific individuals in amongst a very complicated scenario and say, hey, if I could do it with many years later with Jerusalem and Nebuchadnezzar, I can clearly do it with you, Abimelech, because you're so obvious and you're easy to take. So I find Abimelech is this. So God has addressed this. Now, Abimelech, as I mentioned before, appears to have a slight better relationship with God than Pharaoh did. Abimelech then responds to God's instruction, responds to God's reply here. He says, hey, Abimelech had not approached her. He said, why, Lord? This is his God. This is Abimelech's response to God. I assume it's in a dream, but I don't know. My Lord, will you slay a nation even though it is righteous? Did he himself not tell me she is my sister? And she to herself said, he is my brother. In the innocence of my heart and integrity of my hands, I have done this. So again, Abimelech responds assuming it's a nation being destroyed. God didn't say it was a nation. It was just you. just you. Not anybody else, just you. But Abimelech is kind of a grandiose. Well, if you hurt me, you hurt everybody. But I find this interesting. Abimelech talks to God as if he takes credit for not doing anything to Sarah. But he's actually describing it. It's like, hey, I was innocent. I didn't touch her. As if he was so righteous and so great that he prevented himself from... No, God said, yeah, you didn't do... I did that. You didn't do any of this. But like, this is all me. I'm the one who prevented this from happening. So I find God's response somewhat comical. Again, this is my sense of humor. I think God's somewhat making fun of Abimelech's response. That's just how I happen to read it. And that... It's not like you're the righteous individual. Mind you, you're the one who took Sarah against her. You didn't ask, you just took her. That isn't a righteous action. You put her in as if she's your wife. You didn't ask her, do you want to be my wife or not? Nothing of the sort. And he just did so. So there's not much righteousness here. Abimelech didn't have a lot of righteousness in his heart, but God still showed him some kindness. And it was innocent. You didn't try to cause harm, although what you did is not exactly a good methodology. So God said to him in the dream, I too, verse 6, I knew that it was in your innocence of your heart you did this, and I too prevented you. This is God saying, I'm the one who prevented you from sinning against me. And that is why I did not permit you to touch her. But now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not return her, beware that you shall surely die, you and all that is yours. So, and now this Abimelech, who once thought he was semi-righteous or made the claim to God he's semi-righteous, God's pointing, no, you, I did that. That wasn't you. You had nothing to do with it. But anyway, so God calls Abraham a prophet in this storyline, which we don't usually think of Abraham as being a prophet. We think of him as being the father Abraham, and that he didn't spend a lot of time teaching prophecy to anyone. But he did teach instruction, as God had pointed out to Abraham when he first selected him, say, because you are going to teach your children about me and my ways, therefore I'm going to pick you out of all of the nations, all the people in the earth. So God knows Abraham's ability to teach, and apparently it's to his kids, and more specifically to Isaac, because Abraham had other children too, and they decided didn't follow, but Isaac did. So these eggs, Isaac was able to respond to Abraham's teaching. But God calls him a prophet, and this is interesting, is that being a prophet, it implies a couple of things. One, that Abraham is a preacher of some form, because prophets were all preachers. So a preacher of some form, that Abraham would teach people about God. I don't know that he did. I don't have a lot of record of God teaching, other than, of course, his own household. His own household he taught, and meaning his servants. The servants were circumcised like Abraham will be. He's not certain yet, but he will be. And so he did teach that part of instruction, and maybe that's what he's talking about, what God's referring to. But more importantly to me is that telling Abimelech that Abraham's a prophet puts fear and honor from Abimelech to Abraham. It immediately shifts to Abimelech. It's just some man. It's not some dude walking around the street. He's actually a prophet. He knows God. therefore respect him and fear him to some level. I realize many years later, not all the kings of Israel feared the prophets. A lot of them got slaughtered for a result of it. But in general, most, I say most, at least half, I hope half the prophets lived. I don't know the exact number, that the kings didn't slaughter all of them. But the idea was to respect him and cause concern as far as honor to this individual. And that's our connecting thread to Isaiah and to Galatians. This honor of this individual and about how God selected them, that's our connecting thread that threads these three sections together, which we'll get to that shortly. So Abimelech's making this is honor. Okay, I have to honor this individual. And of course, he obviously responds. Unlike, and of course, Abimelech explains his whole, his advisors, hey, bad thing's happening, yada, yada, yada. This is why we go through a storyline. Abraham gives him his three reasons. Abraham thought the country was godless. Okay. Abraham also said, technically, it's true. She's my sister. That's telling half a truth. We tell half a truth, it's really technically lying. Sorry. That's my opinion. We only give half the information. He lied. Anyway, but he did technically partially tell partial truths there, which I can't give a lot of credit for. And Abraham, of course, explains he always does this. This is what he does every country, every nation, every city he does to. So this is a normal thing. Now, this is what's interesting to me about Abimelech. He then responds differently than Pharaoh. See, Pharaoh said, here's your wife. Now get out. Don't come back. Go away. Abimelech didn't respond that way. Abimelech responded in a completely opposite perspective. Here's your wife. Everything is before you. Live wherever you want. You have all the authority to do whatever you want to do. Do what you want. This is your space. That's a different response, isn't it? Instead of the get out, I will see your face again, it's a no, stay. Live wherever. Everything is your position. You have it all. So Abimelech has a different response. He obviously has a more humble attitude, a humble position than the Pharaoh did for Abraham. I can't say all the reasons why, but it does appear that Abimelech does in fact fear God of some level. If he and apparently starts to fear or partially fears Abraham as a response as well. So there is a fear of God in some level to Abimelech, as well as at least as his household. And of course, Abraham responds. So Abraham's initial assertion that in this country there's no fear of God, that isn't actually a true assertion. He may have thought it to be true, but it does not appear to actually be fully true. Maybe partially true, or even possibly mostly true, but not wholly true. There is actually the king apparently does fear God to some level. Even I don't know how much it was, don't know how long it lasted. Abimelech comes later and has some other issues later on. So I can't say how deep the fear was, but there is some level of fear that Abimelech has for God. So it's also, Abimelech also has this problem is that if he offends Abraham, who's now a prophet of God, as God's own word said, then what's to make Abraham intercede on his behalf, right? Abraham has to pray to God to undo this whole sealing up of the womb thing. I'm not sure how bad that was, but obviously it was going to kill, which is interesting. In Judaism, they assume or believe that the God sealed up more than just the wombs of the women. I say that because it was the God said, if you don't fix this, I'm like, you're going to die. It's going to kill you. Well, males don't have wombs. So it's not going to kill us directly if the women can't, wombs get closed up. They may die from, you can't have a period and disease of who else could happen. It could kill them, internal infection, a lot of bad things, but it doesn't happen to men, males. So in Judaism, they assume or believe that Abimelech, God actually closed up the male organ as well. He couldn't pee either, which would be extraordinarily painful and kill you. So that is Jewish philosophy or theory, I guess, that God didn't just seal up the female wombs because he would have sealed up Sarah's too. He sealed up Abimelech's as well. He couldn't actually have any intercourse, obviously, as well as the belief is he couldn't go pee, couldn't relieve himself. And those of you who know a little bit of medically, it won't take long before you die if that's the case. So hence God said it's going to kill you too. There's also other theories about God killed up every orifice, including like the poop hole, everything else, something imaginable is holding. I don't know. I'm not going to go through all those details. So I'm going to write to the board up here. We had the argument that Abraham thought Abimelech didn't fear God, but Abimelech does fear God. So I'll put Abimelech here. Abimelech. And even though he may be from a different country, he is a Gentile. So this is a Gentile person with big Gentile. I can spell Gentile. Spell it terribly. Anyway, he's a Gentile, right? But Abimelech did fear God. So we have fear over on this side. I can't say how much he feared God, but he did fear God. That is a true statement. Whether he feared God his whole life or just for this instance, we can't say, but he did have a fear of God. So at some level, Abraham thought he didn't. Abraham obviously was not completely accurate. He may be mostly accurate, but not completely accurate. Clearly there is some fear going on here, or at least God put fear. If Abimelech didn't have fear before, God put fear in him in this method. Either way, Abimelech did fear, and God obviously responded. So in this category, the fear of God, why do we believe, or why is it, it's quite obvious actually, why does Abimelech fear God? What made Abimelech, even if we knew nothing about his prior life, so let's assume for a minute, prior to this event, Abimelech had never heard of, didn't know God, knew nothing about him. So assume that's the case. We have no record of it one way or the other. Whatever happened, this event resulted at least in his fearing God, right? So this event was spawned, the cause of it was Abraham and Sarah. The interaction of this whole story, right? This caused this event. Now, whether or not the event was deeper than that, and Abimelech had a fear before, I don't know. But this event, it caused the influence of Abraham and Sarah was a direct result in this storyline that we have. So Abraham and Sarah, and Abraham, of course, a prophet of God, right? So Abraham and Sarah, what makes them unique compared to other people of their day? For example, they're monotheists, right? That makes them unique. Everybody else is polytheist, right? That's a very unique thing. Abraham believed God. Therefore, he had the faith, which we call, faith is another word for trust. So Abraham trusted him, right? So we have Abraham's belief. So he has his belief, as well as Sarah. I'm not leaving her out of it. So believe up here. He believed God, and of course, he trusted him. So trust, which we also call, it's also the same word as faith. So this trust and faith in God, all this stuff Abraham and Sarah had was all centered around God, right? This is the character that we know about Abraham. What happened? Oh, there's an I here. Sorry. Thank you, dear. She corrects my spelling. So there's Abraham believed God. There's a trust and faith about God with Abraham and Sarah in their storyline. This act, let's pretend if Abraham never existed, we wouldn't have the story. This act of belief in God is a direct influence or direct factor in this storyline with Abimelech being the Gentile who now fears God. If he feared God before, we don't know, but at least we know he fears him now. So my point behind this is that we have a person, or in this case, two people, whose faith and belief in God directly affected the fear of God in a Gentile king. To the point, we have a God-fearing person, a God-believing person, having a direct effect on a Gentile, non-believing king affecting that nation, at least his household. But of course, the king applied it to his whole nation. He was trying to convince the whole nation how great he is. So it affected the whole nation. This is our connection. This is what we're talking about here today. This is what I want to talk about today. So now let's jump to Isaiah. So don't forget this. We're going to cover this again. Let's jump to Isaiah 61, which also talks about what seems like a different storyline, but it's really not that different. It's actually somewhat similar. It just has its own character. So Isaiah 61, the preceding chapter of Isaiah 61, so Isaiah 60, it talks a lot about different things in particular. It's the talk about the exiles with the diaspora, the people that had left, who were pulled out or will be pulled out, who had left around the whole world, around the whole globe and such. That God's going to come or take them from their various from the world around the world, gather them all together, and they're going to arrive at the kings, or with the kings will arrive also the kings of other nations, and they're going to follow the people that God has selected out. So these individual people in Isaiah 60, where Isaiah 61 is talking to, I can't erase this, but I'll put a little more up here. So I'm going to erase some of them. So Isaiah 61 precedes or follows 60. 60 is the topic matter. 61 is addressing. 61 is talking to these individuals that are talked about or referred to in chapter 60. So they're connected together. So little line here. So Isaiah 60, that addresses the people themselves. This is a people from all over the world. So all the globe, the great diaspora, as this is the people returning, and they're returning to Zion, to Jerusalem. That's who they are, who he's talking to. And in the process of the people returning, the kings from those various nations that came from, whatever nation comes from, the whole globe, they respond to these people who are returning. And these kings are responding and say, hey, I want to follow, I want to attach myself to you, the people, because of this great thing that's happening about the God that your people serve. So that's Isaiah 60. So 61 then continues on with this topic line. And it says, Spirit of the Lord's upon this. I realize this is a reference to Messiah. He quotes it in Luke chapter 4. The Spirit of the Lord's upon me, this referred to Messiah. Because Jehovah has appointed to bring me the tidings to the humbled, and he has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom to the captives, release the bondage for the imprisoned, all that stuff. So the Messiah is talking to these people about himself, that God has selected him to do these things. So the people themselves, people who Isaiah 60 is talking about, who are returning, God is telling Messiah, you, Messiah, are the individual responsible for making this happen. And you're going to take care of them. You're going to bind them, restore them, give them the strength and honor that they should have based on their return. And God already only selects those who return are those who are obedient to him, right? The idea that they're followers of God to some level. So essentially, the people in Isaiah 60:61 are very similar to, not identical, to the type of character that Abraham and Sarah are. These are connected peoples. The same response Abraham has with the belief, the trust in God, as well as his fear of God, of course. But those characteristic qualities that he and Sarah have are the same characteristic qualities the people that are returning, in Isaiah 60 and Isaiah 61 talks to, have as well. Now, Isaiah 61 talks about the specific individual, in this case Messiah, who's responsible for taking care of these people who are returning, right? So 61 talks about a particular individual, in this case, Messiah, and that Messiah is the one responsible for taking care of these individuals. He is a king, right? That's his job, or his assigned responsibility. So in this topic matter, so you obviously release them, and you discuss about this, to bring about for the mourners of Zion, this is verse 3, to give them splendor instead of ashes, oil of joy instead of mourning, a cloak of praise instead of a dim spirit. They may be called trees, or some elms, trees, oaks, various translations, of righteousness, the planting of Jehovah, in which to glory. So, and it also later on in the same passage, he used a reference to this planting as a garden type, that God has planted these individuals as a garden for himself. So these people are basically trees. Now, I don't mean trees literally, I mean trees spiritually. So, and then we know from Deuteronomy 20, which we can go there actually, might as well. So Deuteronomy 20, so no offense to those of you who like English translations, this is kind of messed up in most of our English translations. So it's written strangely, I'm just being honest. So Deuteronomy 20, jumping down to verse 19. Now, I say it's written strangely because the translators had a really hard time understanding the Hebrew text in this case. And so they didn't like what it meant, what it sounded like. So they translated it as if it was a rhetorical question God was asking. There's no rhetorical question. This is a statement God's saying. So I'm going to read it in English, but I'm also going to read it in a more accurate translation of the actual Hebrew text, what it's trying to say. Because I say this because both translations say the exact opposite of each other. One says one thing, one says the polar opposite, the exact definition opposite of each other. And the opposite definition, the one that actually translates from straight from Hebrew, is actually correct. I say it because there's no rhetorical question here. So it explains what this statement that is Isaiah 61 talks about. It also explains later on Messiah in Matthew 21 says the same thing, but he's quoting, not direct quote, but using the implication quote from Deuteronomy 20 to explain Messiah's words in 21, in Matthew 21. So jump to Deuteronomy chapter 20, Deuteronomy verse 19. It says, when you besiege a city for a long time while making war against it to take it, you should not destroy its trees by wielding axe against them. If you can eat of them, do not cut them down to use in the siege. For the tree of the Lord, the tree of the field is man's food. So that's not what it says. That's what it's translated to. What it actually is saying, the last statement there, the last half of that verse, verse 19, part B, the latter half. If you can eat of them, do not cut them down to use the tree in the siege. For the tree of the field is man. That's what it actually says. Tree of the field is man. It's a man. It's a human being. Look at ourselves. Well, what? Men aren't trees. Well, actually, they are trees. they were all trees. Because what do you produce? Good fruit, right? Your actions, what you produce, you're a tree. So when God is referring to the trees in Messiah, that 61, the trees that God is planting as if it's a garden, he's talking about the people themselves because the people are the trees. And Deuteronomy 20 tells us that. I realize some translations screw that up, but it's not about food. Oh, it is. It's about man, the human beings. And that then explains why Messiah's disciples all figured this out. It wasn't genius work of Matthew 20, 21. In the story of the fig tree, the parable of fig tree that seemed really strange. Why did Messiah curse a fig tree? Was he had against figs? What's wrong with that? Oh, Tammy, you have a question? Go ahead, Tammy.
Can you tell us exactly which Hebrew translation you are referencing? Because most of us here have either like NSB or KJV or something like that. Are you using Jewish Bible or yes. What are you using?
Yeah, so both the GPS as well as the which I'm not really a big fan of Art Scroll. It's okay. It's really biased. But they do a really good job translating those words. And when you go through the rabbinical commentary on that section, they talk about that, hey, we're trees. We've always been trees, always have known as trees. So it's been a long-standing tradition for at least 1,800 years that phrase has always meant we are trees. That's what that was the statement. So GPS discusses the trees. The Art Scroll does the trees. I didn't check. Young's literal translation. Pete does a pretty good job on getting tense correct. He got a little weird on some of the words, but the past and present tense does a pretty good job with. So I didn't check all the translations, but a lot of the translations, I can't remember which one it was. I was reading. I forgot where the reference was. Oh, crud! What was it? I forgot. Anyway, it had said that it rephrased it as rhetorical, saying, "Are trees, men, that you make war against them. That's what yours says? Hold on. I'm going to read this. Her translation. This is from, who is this? Complete Jewish Study Bible. Hers reads, there it is.
I reference the NSB, and it does have that NSB rhetorical question that you're speaking of.
Yeah, and the Torah question doesn't belong. This isn't a rhetorical question at all. It doesn't. The Hebrew words do allow rhetorical questions, but it's missing in this passage. They actually have words to refer to rhetorical, and this is not a rhetorical question. So it says. So this one's a complete Jewish study Bible. It reads much like the NSB just pointed out. It says, "Why making war against a town in order to capture it? They siege for a long time. Don't destroy trees, cutting it down with axe." You can eat their fruit, so they're down. After all, are the trees in the field human beings that you so that you have to besiege them too? It's not a rhetorical question. That's not what it says. It's not saying that at all. So that trees of the field are human beings. They are men. And that tells us, wait a minute, if they don't produce fruit, you can cut them down and make your siege works. That's discussed later. So it tells us that the symbolism being described here in the Torah, in the Hebrew text, is saying trees are human beings. Some trees produce good fruit. Some trees don't, right? Those who produce good fruit don't attack them. Those who don't produce good fruit, they're not useful. You can do whatever you need. They're not beneficial to you. That's the idea being described. Messiah discussed the same topic in his reference, which is why it's so obvious to a Jewish mind, I guess. And maybe it took me a little longer to figure out. I don't think Jewish, so beware with me. So in this text, it seems strange just reading on a text. So go to Matthew 21. It raises passages. Well, this is a strange reaction the Messiah had. This is not a normal thing, but it is normal if you know what Deuteronomy 20 is talking about. So at Matthew 21, verse 18, it says, in the morning he returned to the city. He was hungry. He had seen a fig tree by the road. He came to it, found nothing on it but leaves, and said, let no fruit go on you ever again. Immediately the fig tree withered away. Now when the disciples saw it, they marveled, saying, how did the fig tree wither away so soon? And so Jesus answered them, or should I say to you, if you would have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do to the fig tree, but also if you say this mountain to be moved, to cast the sea, it will be done, and all things, whatever you ask in prayer, believing you'll receive. So in that phrase, that's a weird thing, because it wasn't even time for figs. It's a wrong time of year for figs. And that's a strange reaction. It's not so strange if you understand the context that Moses was describing, the idea of God planting people, planting trees. The people are the trees. What do you produce? What value are you? Elisa, you have a question? What's it? Go ahead, Elisa.
I'll be translating for her.
Go ahead.
In the morning, I was listening to a rabbi, and he was talking about precisely about the trees, where it says that God sees us just like trees, planted backwards, that their roots are in the sky and the fruits are below the dirt, and so we need to give fruit to the earth and keep our roots pointed upwards.
That's an interesting imagery. I haven't thought about that one. That's an interesting thought process. That's cool. So the idea being this concept is not a foreign concept. It's a pretty standard concept. But I'd have to think about that. I get the roots of the sky, roots to God, and then the fruit to the ground, fruit to the human beings, to earth. Yeah, that kind of makes sense, actually, in some ways. I just haven't never visually thought what that looks like. That's kind of cool. That it's neat, though. So it's not like it's a foreign idea. This is a pretty standard concept belief system. So in this message of Isaiah 61, the people are the trees. Now I realize it could be any kind of tree, but God's planting this. He discusses, obviously, he also refers to a garden in his same passage. So planted by God in Isaiah 61, those individuals who are planted these trees, what's their responsibility? Back to 61, it says their job in verse 4, good job, Elisa. This actually totally jives with that statement. These people will rebuild the ancient ruins, the wastelands of former times. They'll restore the renewed ruined cities, generations of old wastelands. So that's their job, giving their fruit to God's plan, to God's earth, the restoring of stuff. That's a great imagery. That's a kind of cool way of thinking of a tree upside down. So this whole idea is that's their job, that's their task, these individuals. So giving fruit to God's work is to restore everything did. Now in verse 5, which I would connect to Abimelech in from Genesis 20, the foreigners will stand and tend your flocks, is verse 5, and the sons of the strange will be your plowmen, and your vineyard workers. You will be called priests of Jehovah, ministers of our God, and be said of you, you will eat the wealth of nations and will pride yourselves in their glory. Instead of your shame, which was double, and disgrace, which they would bemoan as their portion, therefore they will inherit a double portion in their land, and eternal gladness will be theirs. So the response of these other nations, other kings, these people, they're going to serve or help these people out in their tasks. And people who once were looked down upon, cursed upon, made fun of, looked as if they were fools, idiots, whatever, none of that will be true. In fact, they'll be the blessed and excessively blessed. Look back at Abimelech and Abraham. Abimelech, after he got essentially humiliated with this whole Sarah and the women and the womb closing thing, very humiliated. He then blesses Abraham, and Sarah says, hey, here's a whole bunch of animals and such. Live wherever you want to live. It's all yours. Do whatever you want. Giving him all the power and strength and security that Abimelech as king of Gerar had to secure that nothing bad would happen to him. So essentially, King Abimelech became Abraham's semi is loosely like a protector, so to speak. I'm protecting you. Nothing bad's going to happen. No one's going to lay a hand on you. A similar thing takes place with Isaac and Rebecca. I can't say it's the same king or not. I know the same name, but it'll be different. Same idea though. And that king then says, I'm going to bestow my strength, my kingship, my power to lift you and take care of you, because Abram and Sarah essentially believed and trusted God. The kings here in Isaiah 61, the nations, which includes kings, the nations here are responding to these people that God's planted, these new trees who give fruit to God's handiwork, the fruit to the earth. And they're responding because they believe and they're like Abraham and Sarah. So that whole point being that we have these groups of people like Abraham and Sarah, their belief, the trust and faith in God. These individual people who God's returning also has belief and trust and faith in God. So these people are of similar nature, and the nations, the other peoples, Abimelech, the other nations, they're responding to these individuals as in a positive fashion, a beneficial way. So they're recognizing that God is with these individuals. And of course, 61 discusses that their king, the Messiah, is in charge of all of them, is making sure, is tending this whole process, making sure this process takes place in healing them and caring for them and such. Because as it reads, for I, Yehovah, who loves justice and hates burnt offerings brought with robbery, this is verse 8, I will repay their deeds in truth and seal an eternal covenant with them. Their offspring will be known among the nations, their descendants amid the peoples. All who see them will recognize them, that they are the seed that Yehovah has blessed. I will rejoice intensely with Yehovah, my soul exalt. This is so the hymn then sings afterward. So God is saying, hey, every nation is going to recognize these types of people, the people who are returning. They're going to be similar to how Abraham and Sarah is in their relationship with Abimelech was. They're going to all see, they're all recognize, all great honor these people who are the trees and produce good things. They're the good fruit. So Messiah's explanation makes sense. Obviously, the Jews of his day would have understood that more so than I did when I read that years ago. I struggled with that seemingly this disorganized event in Matthew 21, because not being a season for figs, why would he do that? It was a lesson. It was trying to teach a lesson about the nature of human beings. What do you produce? Are you producing fruit or are you not producing fruit? And so as a result, your value is based on that. What are you doing? What kind of good fruit do you make? What kind of offering are you giving and helping the world with? What kind of example are you giving? So now I want to jump to Galatians 3. We will and wrap this up with Galatians 3 conversation, how it happens here and what's being described here. So Galatians, as many of you have seen, it can be taken completely out of context and understanding by just extrapolating things out of it. And applying them without understanding what's being said. So remember the Apostle Paul, who's writing this to the Galatian people, this is not his final work. He does a better job with in describing Romans, but the principle is still here. And that when a human being, let's refer to Abraham and Sarah, or referring to the people that God has planted, these new trees he's restored to the earth or to his garden, these two people that Messiah is tending. So In these types of people, there's certain characteristic traits that we understand from them, the way it's being described both in Isaiah 60 and 61, but we'll see 60 describes them. Jeremiah describes them as well in different passages, but describes them similarly. So they're all described the same way. They have this built in or etched in their heart desire to follow God. It's just built into, I have this intense spiritual, emotional, what do you call it, mental, physical desire to do exactly what God asks of me. That sense of honor and love that is so intense, to not wish to dishonor or not wish to treat God lightly, is super strong in all of them. That's how they're being described. So they're not perfect. No one's perfect. Described that their spiritual walk is extraordinarily well developed. Okay, that's what we're talking about. So when you discuss Galatians chapter 3, it's interesting to even to talk about here, because if you didn't understand what was being discussed, You could totally distort this chapter. You could distort the whole book, actually. But what's being discussed here is an interesting concept. So let's jump to verse 15 is what it jumped. We started out in verse 15 of Galatians 3. It says, brethren, speak in the manner of man. This is a King James Version. Though it is only of man's covenant, yet it is confirmed no one annuls or adds to it. So this is a deal with an agreement between two people. Now, to Abraham and to his seed were the promises made. He doesn't say to seeds as many, but to one, to your seed, who, of course, Paul's pointing out is Christ. And then say that the law, which was 430 years later, cannot annul the covenant that was confirmed before God in Christ that should make the promise no effect. For the inheritance is of the law, is no longer of promise, but God gave it to Abraham by promise. So this description sounds kind of like, okay, what are you trying to say, Paul? I don't get it. It's actually not super complicated. It's just worded, in my opinion, funkily. Wordy. Yeah, lots of extra words, unnecessary. I speak a lot of extra words too. I just don't write it that way. I talk fast also. So I'm going to erase a part of this because I have to come back later. So I'm going to erase a small section. I need a little space on my board. So forgive me. I'm going to erase a section of this whole fear thing. We'll keep the Gentile kind item up there. So in this section, we have this idea that's being described here initially, which is not super complicated, but it's still there. It points out that, so you have the promise. I'm going to write this in a little box here. We have the promise God gave. It was given to Abraham and Sarah, but Abraham dominantly. That promise was given roughly 430 years prior to the Torah, which again is consistent because God talked to Abraham like 200 years later. Jacob and all of his family go into Egypt about 200 years later. They come out of Egypt. So yeah, it makes the logic sense. It's logically, time-wise, Apostle Paul is dead on or pretty darn close to his exact years. So the promise given to Abraham, and then 400 years, 30 years later, the law is given. So if the promise of the Messiah, the promise of salvation, the promise of life was dependent upon the Torah of Moses, then we have a 430-year gap, right? We have a gap between the promise given to Abraham and Moses' law. What happens to all those people between that gap? Well, if the promise was from the law, too bad to be them. Bye. Have a nice life in hell, whatever you want to call it. It would make no sense, right? He's pointing out, hey guys, there's an obvious math problem here. Paul's pointing out there's a math problem. You can't argue that the promise of God comes from the law, because then you got a 430-year gap between the promise given to Abraham and before Moses gives the Torah. So all those people, you know, Levi, Judah, Jacob, Isaac, Rebecca, all the people, they just, you know, so long, everybody, have fun, bye, we're going to win and you all lose. That makes no sense. That's ridiculous. So the idea is that he's pointing out, hey guys, you can't argue the law is the source of the promise. That's ridiculous, because then God would be rejecting the very people we pray about, Abraham, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Even Messiah pointed out, hey, he's the God of the living, not the dead. Talk about these people. So that's what made God awesome in his selection of Abraham, is that the promise was applicable even prior to the Torah being given. So Paul's point at the Torah doesn't the promise from God, this salvation, this faith, this trust, belief system that God selected the people to return, is not based on Torah. It's based on the promise God gave. It predates the Torah. That's what he's pointing out. Again, I'm wordy too. I just word at things that I can understand, and Paul words at things that it's harder for me to understand. So it's just how I read things. So that's pointing out, hey, this is just basic math. You can't do basic math. So the inheritance, they inherited the promise. All these people between the promise being given and 430 years later, they're also included too. That's Paul's point. They get included as well. And it's all, but the promise fulfills itself, of course, with Messiah. That's the idea behind it, which happens obviously 2,000 years later. Just in verse 19, what purpose then does the law actually serve? It's added because of transgression to the seed, referring to Messiah, should come to whom the promise was made, and it was appointed through the angels by the hand of the mediator. I'll pause there for a minute. So the law didn't produce a promise. The law was done because we have a problem. We're human beings. We fail. We all fail. A lot of stuff. It's our own inadequacies, our own desires, our own whatever. You can fill in the blank. We have our problems. Now, here's the inherent scenario. So if I put myself in this position, if I'm living 2,000 years ago, however long ago it was, if I'm living in that time period whether between Abraham or Moses or whatever, if I'm living there and I'm a bad person, I mean, I do awful things. Let's, for example, who's a good example? Oh, God killed Judah's first two sons. So I'm Onan or one of those guys, right? The God says, I hate you. You're not worth it. Or I'm Esau or some other person, which is not a very good person in however you want to measure good. So I'm not a very good person. Well, if I'm living in this scenario, living in this belief that I want to follow God, even though I'm not a very good person, well, what would ever cross my mind that God's going to say, hey, you, I'll call myself Jimbo. I kind of want to insult the men who actually lived there, the women who lived there at that time. Hey, you Jimbo, you murder, you rape, you pillage, you do awful things, you lie, you cheat, you steal, all these things you do, and you want to go to heaven. And God's going to say, what? Why would I bring you up to where I live if the all these awful things you do? Well, I could say, okay, God, we'll stop. I stopped doing those things because I think those things are not bad. Not that I would know why I think they're bad, but I'm assuming I think they're bad because the law of Moses wasn't given yet. So I think, okay, I would stop doing these bad things because I think they're bad for whatever reason. I came to this conclusion. However, I did it. Well, how do I rectify my past behavior for what I am now? And God saying, oh, okay, now the past behavior doesn't matter anymore. Well, those mental gymnastics is not easy to do. You can't just throw away your past, unless, of course, your mind is gone. You're going to remember what you used to do. It's going to recall. You're going to recall memory. The people you used to hurt, the bad things you did. So the law is added as a function of addressing these iniquities. Iniquities is a different problem. It does address you, but these inequalities, these problems I have between what I once used to do compared to what I want to do, compared to what my target goal is into heaven. So law has a function. How do I address these mistakes? It's not that it addresses the promise God gave. That's not relevant. It's about the law. The law is designed to address the mistakes that I as a human being make and I can't rectify in my mind, in my way, my actions, my previous behavior versus my current behavior. What I wish to do, what I want to do versus what I used to do. So that's what the law has its function. So law is a functional tool to address those sins, transgressions, and iniquities. So you go on. Verse 20. Now the mediator does not mediate for one. Of course, God's just one. So you have to mediate between two people. But God's, there's only one God. So who's the other mediator for? It's for me, human beings down here, right? Is law then against the promise? Of course not. The law has nothing to do with the promise. The law is about our transgressions of sins, iniquities, transgressions. It's not about the promise of God. These are two totally separate things. The promise of God predates the law. The law is about our sins, transgressions, and iniquities. I do realize there's more in the law of Moses than just that topic. It also covers things of how, you know, the holy days, for example, or Shabbat. It covers those things too. But Paul's talking specifically about the sections or portions that address sins, transgressions, iniquities. That's what he's talking about. That's the subsection, the subcategory of the law he's referring to. Not every imaginable thing, because that would be inclusive of it's saying there's only one God, right? That you should love the Lord your God with heart, mind. So that would be inclusive. It's also written in the law. God, listen, Paul is not referring to that. That makes no sense. He's referring to as he says here, it's added for sin. So it's that section law he's talking about. Halfway through 21. For if there had been a law given which would have given life to the righteous would have been by the law. But the scripture has confined all under sin, and the promise of faith in Jesus Christ might be given to those who believe. Before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for this faith, which would after be revealed. If the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ, then we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we're no longer under the tutor. So pause there for a minute. Great description. Good job, Paul. So in this topic, he's pointing out that the laws of sin, transgressions, iniquities, the reason you obey God is because you have bad things will happen to you. God will be angry or upset with you. Well, the tutor's job was to teach you what is right and what is wrong. Don't do wrong, rather do right. That's its job, to teach you what these things are. Well, once you've accomplished that and learned what those are, how I'm to act, how I'm not to act, then the belief in Messiah, this king is going to be in charge of all of us and addressing the people that God's bringing back to return, that we're replanting up the fruit that they produce, and so the kings take care of them. And of course, Abraham and Sarah, the king being addressed, belief in this system, well, this will outweigh any law of sin. I'm just saying it does. The reality is. And you can ask yourself this, which this is a rhetorical question. Don't answer, but think about it. Christianity, as well as Judaism, both have a similar base faith. That's a Judeo-Christian belief, the biblical description of God. And that's how they kind of base their faith in. In these faiths, which now I realize there are lots of flavors of Christianity, lots of even flavors of Judaism. I'm not discussing the individual flavors, referring to the actual core teachings. In these core teachings, which incorporate, for the most part, all these different groups, how many of them, don't ask, but think about it, how many of the Christian churches or denominations or the Jewish sects teach that adultery is a blessing, wonderful thing to do? How many of them teach that robbing and stealing is wonderful, blessed of God? How many of them teach that murder is a beautiful thing, we should all murder? They don't, right? They don't teach those things. I'm not saying those things don't exist, that human beings don't do them. They surely do, but their core teachings don't teach them, right? It's not consistent with any belief in God, nor is it consistent in any understanding of Messiah in any capacity. So the laws of sins against, the laws against murder, against adultery, against stealing, against all these things that we shouldn't be doing, those are essentially standard fare. That's a normal things we teach, normal things we stand on and all, for the most part, agree to. The belief that there is a monotheistic God, I realize there are flavors of that. I'm not discussing individual flavor belief systems here. But the basic core of a monotheistic belief system is also pretty much a standard teaching amongst the Judeo-Christian beliefs. I realize there are differences, but that's and what it looks like. But that's the kind of general idea. So for the most part, the law regarding them is not, there's not like it's not relevant. It is relevant, but once you have accepted Messiah as your king, by definition, you've also already accepted God as your God. And by definition, you already have a sense of trust and faith built in. You already have a belief system, a core belief system to do what is right. You already have the basic foundation needed to be an obedient servant to God. And that once you've accepted that point, walked to that point spiritually, the law, which was teaching you what you should and shouldn't do, is not super relevant. It's not that it's wrong. It just isn't relevant to your personal life because you're like, well, that's obvious. Of course, I wouldn't murder people. That's dumb. I wouldn't steal stuff. That's ridiculous. I'm not going to commit adultery. That's ridiculous. It's so far beyond your faith, your walk, that you wouldn't do it anymore because you've matured past it. It's not the law had no value. It did. It taught you what they were. But once you've accepted this point in your belief system, it doesn't have a lot of teeth behind it anymore because it's so obvious. Why would you do those things? That's ridiculous behavior. So that's what he's trying to explain here. The law, once you've gone past the tutor, the instructor, wrong, is not really relevant anymore because way you never break them. Of course, you're not going to break the law. That's ridiculous. No one would ever do that. That's the idea behind it. That's what he's trying to point out. Now, I realize Apostle Paul, at his day, does not have the full smorgasbord spectrum of all the different theological teachings the past 2,000 years under his belt. There's been a lot of variations, people's incorporating various pagan ideas into their concept of God. Paul's not an advocate for pagan incorporation. He doesn't advocate for that. So that is a twisting or alteration of the faith of God and this obedience to God's words. But that's beyond the scope of our discussion today. So continue on. Verse 26. For you are all sons of God through faith in Jesus Christ. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, neither male nor female. You are all one in Christ. And if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the same promise. So by accomplishing this concept, by being like Abraham and Sarah, the people that God's pulling, returning through discussing in Isaiah 61, and under the King Messiah, which is he's talking to, he's talking about this individual regarding these individuals in Isaiah 60 that he's pulled. By being in this category, by adopting or attaching yourself to this category, the examples given to us in Genesis and Isaiah 60, 61 seems to influence the other category of Gentiles, the Abimelech category for Abraham, and the nations that are around the people returning in Isaiah 61. So this act of belief, trust, faith in God seems to have an inherent impact on the behavior of the nations around them, right? They seem to influence them. They seem to appear to respond in a positive manner to those actions, to those behaviors, to those responses. So it tells us that God is not just blessing these people because he likes them, or to bless them because they're wonderful people. He's using their blessings to affect the behaviors of others who are around them in a positive fashion. That tells us it gives the better explanation as how God uses what Exodus 19 talks about. So I'm making you a kingdom of priests and kings. So the nations will see what you do and respond positively to them, as God has explained. That was his goal. So in this section of Galatians 3, Paul's pointing out that in this belief system, it has progressed in an ideal candidate, a person, human being. It's progressed to a point where the promise of God is highly effective. It's applicable. It applies to them because they've walked so far through their obedience to God that their faith is strong in following God and following the Messiah as their king, but following God specifically. So that faith is super strong, affecting the nations around them. And as a result, those nations affect in a positive way. They're blessed too, bottom line. They get blessed too. And this, the belief system, both the people as well as Abraham, is not exclusive to the Israelites alone. Well, that's Paul's point. Hey, there's more people than just this category, than just the descendants of Abraham, just the descendants of Israel. There's more people who could be included in this, to where hence Jew and Gentile is not a relevant thing, which Ezekiel agrees with. It's not relevant. They both find that, hey, that's not the important part. Whether you're Jew or Gentile is not a factor being discussed here. It's the belief and trust and faith of obedience to God by just your instinctive behavior. Now it's so deeply etched in you that behavior will affect those kings and nations and Gentiles who have a weaker understanding, a less fulfilling walk in their life or relationship with God, that they'll respond in a positive way. Abimelech responded in a positive way. The nation of the world responds to Messiah and the people that God is planting in a positive way. And the responsibility of these people, as God says, hey, you're my trees, you're producing good fruit. The fruit that you produce is what's evident, and you are serving or helping what God wants you to do. You're producing good positive things. And that is affecting people. So the common thread, at least how I see it, the common thread between these three sections is the behavior of the individuals, their belief system and faith and trust in God is so well developed that breaking the law is not relevant. It's not really a concept that's advocated for, but it's so important that this promise now makes functional, applicable sense. And that's how we can apply it to all of these individuals and not be isolated to this narrow focus of well, just obedience to Moses is all that matters. It's so far beyond obedience to Moses. That's a given. That's obvious obedience to Moses. That's not even a discussion matter or topic to even consider. It's the idea that belief and trust in God and in that promise they gave, that's the focus that we're moving on to, walking past, not away from, but walking as if we've already mastered the law of Moses in our faith and our walk with God, then influencing the people around us accordingly. That's kind of what's being discussed. This is how I see it. Hope we didn't lose anybody in this discussion. I know it's a lot to throw at you, but we have lots of examples in the prophets that also reiterate the same message. Jeremiah, of course, discusses this a number of times. 3 and as well as 31, the very place Jeremiah discusses this topic, this exact same discussion, that's also reiterated. Isaiah does it a few times. Isaiah chapter 2, as well as 55. If you do places, Isaiah discusses this. Zephaniah discusses it also, but a slightly different flavor version of this imagery. Zephaniah discussed it multiple times, not so much as the influential factor of these individual people, meaning Sarah and Abraham, or the people of God's returning. Zephaniah focuses on this character here, known as Messiah, as him being the driving force of the nations that follow God. So all of these are really, bottom line, these are all connected scenarios. We can't really equally or fairly separate Abraham and Sarah, separate them separate from the people returning to God, or separate any of them from Messiah himself. All of them are really so heavily attached, intertwined. They're not synonymous, but they're actually very heavily connected. So Zephaniah connects Messiah as the same driving force that Isaiah connects the people as well as Messiah as the driving force. And Abraham and Sarah's behavior was their driving force. And obviously Moses advocates also that your behavior, how you respond, is your driving force of how you affect nations around you. Paul points out it's your belief system after you've mastered the laws of Moses, it's your belief system and faith in that promise given that is your driving force, also a factor in affecting the nations and nations, Gentiles around you. So all of these things are conglomerate or grouped together in both our prophet section, our Torah portions, as well as in our New Testament Christian scriptures. They all advocate the same principle. Our behavior, how we respond to the belief system of God, our faith, as well as our obvious obedience to the laws of Moses, because that's a given, are all driving forces that affect the nations and people around us. How many of us have come from alternate backgrounds, right? From whether you were a child or whether a faith you were raised up in, and some experience in life, whatever it was, or maybe people in your life, affected you in a positive way and put you where you are now. Most would answer, well, yeah, I could actually list a few people off who affected me. Scenarios, storylines that I experienced, things that happened to me. It's that promise, it's that faith that people have that affected me and got me where I am. So not just is this a responsibility from Abraham and Sarah or the people returning to Messiah, it's not just my responsibility to act like them. I actually experienced being on the receiving end of this and how it affected me. So it's also, it's a second witness that most of us have had some past or background, whatever it is, that was left us in from one path and we shifted paths to the path we're on now. These affected us. Faith of people, the people that we run across affected us. The storylines we lived through affected us in a positive way that we are now can easily include ourselves. No problem. This belief and trust and faith in God, sure, got that, I'm there. This belief that I can be the people that God's returning to planting that produce good fruit. Yep, God, I'm there, not a problem. The belief in Messiah is be my king. Yep, God, I'm there, not a problem. It's easy to say that now, but some of us are past 20, 30, 40 years ago, depending on how old you are, may not be able to say that. May not be able to be in that position in our spiritual walk, whatever that walk was, whatever activities we were doing, right or wrong. But those walks, those influences that other people brought to us affected us in this exact same descriptive way we're now learning or reading about in our Torah portion, as well as in our Haftorah portion, as well as the Apostle Paul's writings. We're reading what we, many of us, have experienced in our own personal life. To reiterate that this is a true statement. This is what they're saying. This is actual reality. This is how God was working for people. Does that make sense? Did I lose anybody? I may have lost a few of you. I apologize for that. Any questions or comments or disagreements? I'll entertain all of them. I guess that was it then. Oh, Ann, you had a question? Go ahead, Ann.
In going back some time ago when you were speaking, the idea of a person having Alzheimer's or some dementia issues as they're older, that mm-hmm. Do they become once again like the innocent child before age, 13? Before the age of reason comes in, or is it, I mean, they may not remember murdering somebody or doing something evil in the past.
Right.
So
right. They're past.
How does the judge look at that issue? I mean, the ultimate judge.
Yeah. That is a super hard question. And all I can give is my suggested belief system. You don't have to agree with me on this because that's not an easy question. I'm being honest with you. It's a hard one. There are people who've committed evil sins, like really bad stuff they've done to other people, to children, like awful people. And as they got older, they've lost their minds. they're dementia, Alzheimer's. They have no recollection. They can't do anything about it. It's all gone. How God handles that, I don't know. To be honest, I just don't. All I can say, I can hope. Now, I can't say I can believe this. I can hope for this because I don't know that somehow prior to their losing their mind, maybe they repented and then God will address them during whenever the resurrection takes place for them, however many years or decades or centuries later. Whatever that happens, when God addresses that individual, that God can address them at that time. I just can't answer those questions. They're super complicated and highly emotional. Because, for example, let's say the victim of that person, whoever that victim was, they say, wait a minute, God, how can you forgive them for what they did to me, right? And when we struggle with these topics, these are not easy things to talk about. They're really hard. And they're not just a simple, oh, well, God will forgive everybody. Well, okay, yeah, tell that the people that got murdered in the Holocaust. Oh, God will forgive all these Nazi soldiers. You know what? That's really hard. That's a hard thing to answer. So even if the Nazi soldiers all forgot what they ever did, it's hard to answer. I do realize that we as human beings have a fundamental responsibility to offer forgiveness when possible. Not necessarily in every scenario, but when possible. Because if we don't give forgiveness, we're not going to get forgiveness from God. Just like if we don't give mercy, we don't receive mercy from God. If you don't give, you only give what you can receive. So I can't speak to being a victim like that. I can't speak to being a perpetrator like that. I haven't been a perpetrator like that. I've not been a victim. I realize those are super, super emotional and psychological traumas for some people. Other individuals who've been, who have lived a relatively mild life, I haven't done a whole lot, but they lose their mind anyway. They might not remember much at all. Again, God didn't have to sort those things out because I can't speak to them. I imagine in my mind, this is my just imagination. There's no real, evidence behind it per se. I imagine in mind that somewhere along their walk in their life, whenever some point in time in their life, God, if he wanted to talk to that individual, he probably would have. And maybe he did. I don't know. He probably would have talked to them at some point in time in life if he wanted to talk to them and address whatever struggles or problems or personal issues they had or transgressions they've done or iniquities they've done to deal with those problems. I hope God had some plan, some solution in mind for those scenarios. There's not like a biblical record discussing people's losing their mind with Alzheimer's. They don't discuss that topic. There's a lot of people that are born with horrible diseases, right? Mental disorders, they're just completely non-functional. That happens. Bible doesn't talk a lot about those individuals, so I can't say how God's going to respond to them. I don't think God ignores them or neglects them like they don't exist. Somehow God's probably has, I believe, or I think God has some solution about that, but I don't know what that is. I do realize that some people lived a good life, reasonably good, whatever good means, you can decide, and they still lose their mind as they get older. My mother has her ups and downs in life, the things she did right and wrong, everybody does. But for the most part, she lived a pretty decent life the last number of decades. So she's tried her best, good or bad, she tried her best to do what is right. But she's she's losing parts of her mind now. She doesn't remember everything anymore, doesn't remember a lot of stuff anymore. So she struggles with that stuff. I suspect God does not bring all the sin, transgressions, iniquities to mind for every single individual. I suspect he says, okay, you've lived, you've repented, whatever that repentance is for this individual, referring to, of course, her mother in this case, whatever repentance you lived, that is sufficient enough for this scenario. I can't speak to major crimes. I don't know. I don't know how God handles pedophiles and who lose their mind. I don't know. I have a hard time. I'm not in his position, so I can't tell you what he's going to do. Or murderers, or rapists, or whatever, who lose their mind. I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. That's a harder question. That is really it requires a lot of counseling type of discussion matter that I can't answer. Pat had your hand up a second there. I guess you took it down.
I did. Only that I had worked in a nursing home for some time. And one of the things that, even though you could tell people were Christian even when they were had dementia. They still had that godly heart. And when they passed away, those who had been followers of God passed away very peacefully. Those that hadn't been were not as peaceful.
Interesting.
And that's my only experience with it. But I believe God gives us the chance to repent as humans because he does care. There's a scripture that said his will is that none should be lost. And so it is our choice, ultimately.
That's an awesome input. I've not been around a lot of people who passed away. Obviously, my grandparents, but they were both believers in God. So they were pretty peaceful. But I can't speak to what it's like for those who are not. That's an interesting input. Thank you, Pat. Any comments or questions about this topic or any topic we discussed today? I hope I didn't lose anybody. I didn't think it was a very complicated subject matter, but it can be if you're not clear on it. Hopefully I didn't lose anybody. John, you have a question? Go ahead, John.
I'm looking at Galatians 3:21, and I'm wondering about righteousness. What is righteousness? Is it just doing right? And the difference between, seems like knowing what doing right means would be from knowing the Torah, but it says that you're declared right from beliefs. I'm just curious about the distinction.
That's an excellent question. Let me erase some of this on my board. We'll discuss just for a couple of minutes. Won't take long. All right. So erase some of this stuff. So when we deal with the topic of righteousness, what that is and what that's not, it's commonly used in our law of Moses, right? The laws of Moses that gave to us, that God gave through Moses, as doing right. So we're doing it right. It implies what our actions or what we're doing is based on what God says is right versus wrong, right? So righteousness is the attribute to something. Attribute. I think that's how you spell attribute. Two T's? Ah, thank you. Well, now it looks like an H. Anyway. Attribute rightness, the idea of something that is correct / correct, also known as justified. These are all not synonyms, but used somewhat interchangeably. Justified meaning verified that this was the right solution, the correct solution. These are all attributed to an individual or a person being right or being correct or being justified in what they did, right? That because justified is a little bit, as we think about it, yeah, you can justify something that's wrong, but it's not justified, then is it, right? But you can justify if it's more right than the other solution, right? You can do that, can't you? Yeah, you're like, yes, you can. You know that. So justified is a little bit looser in its restriction, isn't it, than just plain righteousness, isn't it? We can justify something that is correct. And I don't mean incorrect to justify. I don't mean arguing a wrong thing is right and it should be right. Justification, true biblical justification is I have multiple people. Let's, for example, the best one is King Solomon, right? King Solomon and the two harlots, right? So they both were harlots. Is harlotry a justified or righteous business position, job? No, it is not. There's no righteousness in harlotry. But you have these two scenarios, two harlots, right? One, they both had kids. One, of course, dies. We have the baby. They rolled over the baby, yada, yada, yada. They swap kids around. And Solomon says, okay, I have to justify, meaning correct this scenario, and figure out which woman, which harlot, is the correct, just, righteous parent. Offers, take a sword. Let's cut the baby in half and split it. Brilliant solution, right? The real mother says, wait, no, please let the child live. Now we have an understanding of the example of righteousness. What was the mother's response? Was it right for the mother to offer to, hey, no, let the other person take the child? No, that's not right because it's the wrong solution, right? The real mother should have the child. That's the correct solution. That's what the Torah would say, right? Or if Torah had a comment on it, that, hey, the mom's the mom. You can't change the mom. But she determined that, wait a minute, it is more right, more justified to keep the child alive and pass them to the other individual than it would be to enforce my rights as the mother and result the child being sliced in half, right? That's an example of how righteousness is not as clean, or is not always as clean as we like it to think to be. We can have scenarios where righteousness can be attributed to something that is right, which we intuitively say, well, that's obviously wrong. It's the wrong mom. But But the solution being that the survival of the child was more important than the right of the parent. See how that works? So justification is also part of this process of righteousness. It was justified, the mother's decision to, I'd rather forego my right as a parent and let the child live. That attributed righteousness to both Solomon, of course, obviously the mother too. So this whole process works. So right or righteousness is not just restricted to Torah law alone. It's actually application, using or applying it in a difficult or hard scenario. There are scenarios where there is someone who has multiple wives or multiple husbands or divorce, all these various things in life, right? Well, we have to decide, okay, how do we solve these problems? These problems are not easily solved, but you have to determine of these bad choices, they're both bad choices, which is the more right choice? Actually, a good point there. So fellowship, Rahab's deceiving of her countrymen about the spies of Israel. Great example. That's also a wonderful example of this scenario. So she, thank you for bringing that up. I didn't even think about that. But so she in Jericho is saying, okay, I have an obligation to take care of my town, my city, my fellowship, my nation, all this town I live in. But I also know God's with those people over there. So I'm going to lie to my people, my own soldiers, and lie to them, seeing the spies and having them escape. And of course, God says, good job, Rahab. You live, your family lives, everybody else dies. The example she has, a girl who slept with who? Her father-in-law. Her father-in-law. Who? It was Tamar. Tamar and Judah. Tamar and Judah, right. Another example. Now we say, well, that's a terrible thing. She pretended to be a harlot. Judah slept with her. She had twins, but she was pregnant, obviously. And Judah said, kill her. And she said, this is the husband who, or the male, she said, not husband, the male who I am pregnant by. And he determines she's more righteous than I am, right? Because I didn't give her my son like I promised. So even in that, there's also example of, well, both these are wrong, right? Having sex with your daughter-in-law and getting her pregnant, that's a wrong thing. It's very, very, very wrong, right? And you also have, well, murdering or killing somebody is also not a good thing. That's a negative thing. But she's saying, hey, the whole story is really complicated, right? Both parties are wrong. She was wrong for what she did. He was wrong for what he did. And he determined she's more righteous than I am in this story. So righteousness is actually not just an application of the law of Moses. It's application of the law of Moses with the intent of what is good or what is the best solution in this particular scenario. Most of us have a laundry list of sins we've done, right? And some of them should be, according to the law of Moses, be executed for. And God doesn't. God doesn't execute. He gives us mercy. And that was more righteous in this story, as far as these examples God gives to each of us as individuals, than actually executing us. If God said, okay, we'll apply the law of Moses strictly, then unfortunately, I don't think Moses would be alive anymore. Just being honest, Moses would be dead for various reasons in our past history. So righteousness is more complicated than just saying apply laws of Moses. But you cannot apply righteousness having no knowledge or comprehension of the laws of Moses. See how that works? Let's pretend Solomon or had no comprehension of what was right and wrong, meaning what Moses said was right and wrong. Had no knowledge of it at all. Well, number one, I doubt he would have been written about, but his solution to slice people in half wouldn't have made any sense. So righteousness, you're right, John, in that it's not completely devoid of the law of Moses. You have to understand or comprehend the basic principles or function of the law of Moses for righteousness to make sense. Now, in the case of Abraham, God said Abraham believed that the Apostle Paul discusses it. Abraham's belief, his faith, God attributed to him as righteous. Righteousness was right. That's what God attributed to him. Now, of those two parties, Abraham and God, which one knew right and wrong? God did, right? So God applied righteousness to Abraham. Either Abraham doesn't have Moses' law listed and written down. He didn't know, he may have known some principles behind it, but he didn't have the laws of Moses written down. But the individual applying righteousness, meaning make the determinant Abraham was righteous, God, he did know the laws of Moses, even though they weren't written down yet, because God made them up. They're his laws, so he knows them ahead of time. So God attributed righteousness to an individual. The individual didn't necessarily know what was right or wrong, but God knew, and God said, because your faith, that is sufficient enough to attribute righteousness to you. In the case of the harlots with the Solomon, both women, I'm sure, knew what they were doing was wrong as far as being in harlotry, but that's their line of business. So it is what it is. Solomon would have known the laws of Moses. Of course, the Torah requires it. You kings have to copy it down. So Solomon makes a decision on these women, and the one who says, hey, keep the child alive. I don't know how much of the Torah she knew, but she had to know some of it at some level because she's obviously an Israelite. But the righteousness being applied to this scenario, making the determination who was just or who was not, was being done by Solomon. Who decided where the child goes? Solomon did. Solomon said, yep, now we know the truth. The child goes to that one. Righteousness is now restored. The one who attributes righteousness to something has to they themselves know or comprehend what they are attributing. They would be responsible to know, I'm applying the laws of Moses in this way, or I'm applying the law of mercy in this way, or whatever, fill in the blank. They have to be aware enough or familiar enough to actually apply that righteousness to an individual or to a group of people. So it's not that righteousness is devoid of the law of Moses. It's not. The individual applying righteousness to the other person, that individual needs to necessarily know or comprehend what was right and what was wrong. When it came to Judah and Tamar, Judah doesn't know the law of Moses very well because it wasn't written down. He probably knew some stuff, some basic principles, not very much. But in his storyline, he had to have known enough to say, hey, I am more wrong than her. Therefore, he had to know that the right thing to do by attributing righteousness to her and letting her live, as opposed to killing her, he assumed that this was the correct solution. So basically, the person who has the authority to attribute righteousness has to have more knowledge or comprehension of what the laws of Moses, the laws of God are, in order to actually do that. Does that make sense? Hopefully, yeah. I didn't lose you on that.
In the New Testament, there's a really good example, too, where the woman that had committed adultery, men were going to stone her to death. Christ came along and said, he who is without sin, throw the first stone. And slowly, one by one, they walked away. And then Jesus turned to her and said, neither do I continue, but go and sin no more. In other words, you've been forgiven, but don't go sin anymore. Don't repeat your sin.
Right. And end your past behavior for this forgiveness to essentially forgiveness to stick, to stay. End your previous conduct, your previous past, whatever you used to do. Stop that. And this righteousness, this mercy being given to you will actually stick, will stay with you for however long that's going to be, however long you live. So another great example. So, but all the scenarios we have that's cited here, that I cited as well as other examples too, the person attributing the righteousness, dominantly, of course, was God in most scenarios. He knows his law well. So he's going to apply when it's correctly to apply and obviously give us as human beings good examples to see how that works and how to apply it correctly too. I would not go to Hitler to ask for righteous justification on treating people well, right? Being kind to people, right? Because Hitler is a bad example. He could not give me righteousness or justification for that, right? That'd be bad. Clearly, I'm using this obvious example. So you can't get righteousness applied to you by someone who is more wicked and evil in every capacity than you are in this scenario. It wouldn't make any sense. They don't have the authority to give righteousness. They themselves are too horribly unrighteous. So the righteous requires to apply it to someone that has applied from a person who is greater than them in that scenario. It may not be greater than them in every scenario, at least that particular subject matter, they're greater than them in that particular subject matter. Judah had his problems. He wasn't greater than Tamar in every scenario. But in that scenario, he realized, okay, I have the authority. I know what's right and wrong. Yep, she was more right than I am. He could do so. Obviously, he could do it to his own two older sons. I don't know what that's about. Or even Eli, for example. Eli and his two sons. He did not do right by his sons. Even though he had the ability to apply righteousness to them and kick them out of the priesthood, he failed to do so. He had the authority to, he just failed to. And God said, I'm going to kill you and your sons because you failed to actually reprimand them like you're supposed to. You failed to justify, meaning kick them out or make them stop, whatever the case would be. He failed to do so. He didn't do his job by applying righteousness correctly. He gets booted out along with his sons. So these examples of people who failed to do it, who had the responsibility and the authority to actually do it, but failed to. That's an example of also the opposite extreme.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.